Ellis Burke had his ever-present cell phone to his ear as he inched along in heavy traffic on the interstate.
Hey, it's not like it's the end of the world, old buddy Roo. Trust me, this is just a minor setback. We'll still get everything we want from those bastards at the insurance company. You remember everything I told you, right? You don't ever step outside the house without that collar around your neck. You stupid asshole! No, not you, Mitch. I'm talking to this guy in front of me who won't get off his brakes. Yeah, you just do like I say, and paydays are coming. Hey, who's the lawyer here, you or me? I've handled hundreds of these cases, thousands. Those insurance sons of bitches will cave, you'll see. Okay, no, that's all right. No need to apologize. Of course you worry about it. You're out of work. Your family's future depends on this settlement.
So did the next payment on Burke's caddy, but he didn't say anything about that to the client. It was always best to keep it all about them. Never remind them their lawyer stood to collect a big chunk of change from the case, too. He needed the money as much as Mitch Sherman did. Otherwise, he was going to have to choose between the car payment and the child support payment. Couldn't make them both this month. But he was confident the insurance company's lawyers would give in once they strutted around and acted like hardasses for a while. They had to justify the big retainer the insurance company paid them. Ellis Burke didn't know why. Instead of paying off legions of high-priced attorneys, insurance companies didn't just deal fairly with the folks who filed claims against them. Hell, they had all the money in the world to start with. It was only fair they spread some of it around.
All right, Mitch, all right. I'm glad you called. I'll be in touch. Nah, at this point, we can't really expect any movement until next week. It's Thanksgiving in a couple of days. People are already thinking about turkey, football, and Christmas shopping instead of lawsuits. Give me a call on, Wednesday if you haven't heard anything from me, okay? Okey-doke. Yeah, bye-bye.
Burke closed the phone and slid it into his shirt pocket.
Asshole. Aw, come on, Ellis. It's not Mitch's fault. He was born and raised in a state full of gun-nut, execution-loving assholes. Assholes who don't know how to drive! Can't you just go on and get out of the friggin' way?!
An endless parade of vehicles clogged the highway in front of him. Traffic hadn't come to a dead stop, but it was really creeping along. Burke wished he was back in New York, where people used public transportation. You'd think with all the ugly empty space in Texas, the highways wouldn't be so damned crowded. That was because too many damn Yankees moved down here, to hear the local yokels tell it. Ellis got fed up with them getting mad whenever somebody with some common sense, namely him or somebody else from an actual civilized state, tried to explain you couldn't keep doing things the same way just because Cousin Zeke and Uncle Jed did them the same way for the last 150 years. Frickin' Wild West lunatics with their gun racks, their racist Confederate rebel Nazi bumper stickers, and their love affair with a death penalty. What was he doing down here in this Lone Star Insane Asylum anyway? Fighting for justice, that's what. He couldn't let himself forget that. His was the voice of Blue State Reason and Sanity, crying out in the Red State Wilderness. When his wife said she wanted to move back home, back to Texas, at first he said forget it. He wouldn't be caught dead in such a backward place. But since she was pregnant, she wanted to be closer to her mama. That was the way she phrased it, too. Closer to her mama. Burke supposed he could understand that. He agreed, figuring as smart as he was, he could run rings around those cracker lawyers down south. What he hadn't reckoned with was the good old boy network that ran from the very bottom to the very top of the Texas legal system. Bastards shut him out. He wasn't one of them. He couldn't get the important cases, the cases where he might be able to make an actual difference and do some good for the common man. No, he was reduced to taking on personal injury lawsuits on a contingency basis. Not even the big money tier of those. He supplemented what he made there with DUI and drug possession and hot check defenses. He found himself dealing with world-class Bubbas and Bubettes. He told himself he was doing some good by getting fair settlements for people who deserved them, but it was a far cry from saving the world as he set out to do, wasn't it? Since traffic wasn't moving, he glanced at himself in the rearview mirror. When did his face get so broad, red, and beefy? When did those lines appear around his eyes? What the hell was Gray doing in hair that was supposed to be thick and black? Less than 10 years in Texas, and already the handsome young liberal firebrand who came out of law school in New York was gone. He never should have listened to Rebecca. He should have insisted they stay right where they were. If they had, he would be in politics by now. He'd be a congressman, maybe even a senator. He'd be in Washington, where he could really accomplish something, instead of creeping along a crowded interstate north of Fort Worth, just another ambulance-chasing shyster. Worst of all, Rebecca was gone. She got tired of him and left, taking their daughter Vicky with her. Burke had no shot at getting custody, not with the affairs he had, the drunken driving charge, even though he got it dismissed, and all the other crap Rebecca threatened to dredge up if she had to. He went along with what she wanted, so Vicky wouldn't have to be dragged into a nasty court fight. If he wanted to be honest about it, he wouldn't have had a whole lot of ammunition to use against Rebecca anyway. She was a smart woman. Just not smart enough to realize she shouldn't have married some handsome young crusading attorney when she went off to New York to study art. Burke took both hands off the steering wheel, since the car wasn't moving anyway, and spread his fingers.
Where the hell did all these people come from anyway?
When he, his wife, and daughter moved north of Fort Worth, this area wasn't even the suburbs, it was country. So country, the quiet at night creeped Burke out. But DFW Airport was close, and the cities of Fort Worth and Dallas weren't much farther away. They called it a megalopolis now, stretching for almost 100 miles from east to west, and still growing. In recent years, growth exploded northward, taking in Denton, a picturesque little university town. Alliance Airport, a sprawling air freight hub for the entire region, gobbled up thousands of acres of what was once farm and ranch land. A NASCAR track went up not far away. Housing and shopping, hotels and restaurants soon followed. Just in the time Ellis Burke lived here, the country disappeared, replaced by mile after mile of the worst urban sprawl. The air pollution and traffic were so bad, people were starting to call the area Little L.A. But it didn't have any of L.A.'s benefits, because it was populated by a horde of mouth-breathing rednecks. Burke did his best not to let them corrupt him with their racist attitudes and rampant consumerism. He still read the New York Times instead of any of the local rags. He donated money to the local PBS station every time they had a pledge drive. He listened to NPR. He wished he could drive a more fuel-efficient car, maybe a hybrid, but he found that he needed the caddy for his image. People down here didn't take a lawyer seriously unless he drove a Cadillac or a Lincoln. He tried to fight back with bumper stickers that savaged the previous administration and boosted the current one. He found a surprising number of locals agreed with him, proving not everybody in Texas was a reactionary, knuckle-dragging conservative. Despite everything, though, sometimes you just had to go with the flow. Like today, when he found himself driving around looking for the one thing his daughter wanted most for Christmas, some sort of singing, dancing, overpriced puppet thing, probably made in Taiwan by slave labor in some sweatshop run by a corrupt dictatorship propped up by American military and financial aid. But Vicky wanted it, so he was going to do his best to find it. No luck so far. The company didn't make enough of the little bastards in that sweatshop. Either that, or the company was holding them back to create more demand so they could jack the price up higher. Just the thing companies did all the time, having learned their lesson from Big Oil. It would serve the corporations right if everybody stopped buying for a while, just stopped buying everything to teach the fat cats a lesson. See how long the consumer-driven economy could stand that. The thought made him grin. But of course it would never happen, because little girls like his daughter wanted toys. Everybody wanted toys. So the corruption rolled on, and Ellis Burke was part of it, whether he wanted to be or not. If worse came to worst, he told himself as he wiped sweat from his forehead, he knew where he could get the thing Vicky wanted. They'd have it at the new Ultra Mega Mart about to open just up the road a couple of days from now on Friday. Going to that high temple of American excess would be an ordeal, but he supposed he could do it for his daughter. It would have to be Friday, too, the day after Thanksgiving, because after that they might be sold out of the blasted thing. That eased his mind a little. Sure, he hated the thought of braving a crowd of unwashed rednecks, especially after they spent the entire day before stuffing their faces with Thanksgiving dinner, drinking beer, and rooting for the damned Dallas Cowboys, but he could do it. For Vicky, for his little girl, how bad could it be? The apartment complex was not new, not fancy, but it appeared to be fairly well cared for. The parking places were not reserved, so he slid his car into one of them and stopped. The long drive from Kansas City left Hamid stiff. He tried to unkink the sore muscles. He was aware of the gun tucked behind his belt at the small of his back, its butt covered by the tails of the loose shirt he wore. He didn't carry it there for the whole trip, of course, too uncomfortable. But as he approached his destination, he took the weapon from between the car's bucket seats and concealed it under his shirt. He didn't know what he was walking into, but he wasn't going to do it unarmed. The apartment number was 427, but the building was only two stories. It was arranged in a square around a central courtyard with a swimming pool. Signs were posted on each leg of the square, listing the numbers of the apartments. Hamid found 427 without trouble. It was on the second floor, overlooking the drained, empty pool. Hamid was surprised when a woman opened the door, a very attractive woman at that, although her long, raven-black hair should have been covered instead of displayed so openly and shamelessly. Hamid concealed his reaction.
Hi. I'm looking for Steve.
Sure, he's here.
The woman stepped back from the door.
Come in.
Hamid froze as the woman pressed what felt like the barrel of a gun against the back of his neck. McCabe was glad to be home. The rest of the run went just fine, no problems, after that little fracas a couple of nights earlier at the truck stop. He made it on down to Jacksonville, delivered his cargo, and deadheaded back to Fort Worth, something of a rarity in this day and age with the price of fuel. Somebody in transportation up in Kansas City fouled up, because McCabe wasn't supposed to pick up another load at the distribution center at Alliance Airport until Monday. But that was Megamart's problem, not McCabe's. He was just looking forward to spending the Thanksgiving holiday at home for a change, instead of carrying merchandise across the country. Maybe he would even do some shopping with his wife and daughter. Seemed fair, considering he spent most of his days delivering things for other people to buy. He was an independent operator for a while, after retiring from the military, and liked it. After being part of a group for so long, it felt good to be on his own, responsible for nobody but himself. Problem was, he wasn't responsible just for himself. He had a wife and a daughter to take care of, too. And he felt Terry and Ronnie deserved the best possible life he could give them, since they spent so many years pretty much taking care of themselves on various military bases around the country, while he was off on missions around the world, to some of the most hellish spots on the face of the earth. They had it rough sometimes, too. Low pay, endless red tape, frequent moves. Terry and Ronnie dealt with most of it alone. They always came through, though. His guys, he called them, because of their masculine nicknames. They didn't want to be Teresa and Veronica. They preferred Terry and Ronnie. Not that there was anything remotely masculine about them, except their nicknames. At 38, Terry still claimed the same earthy cowgirl-type beauty as the cultish 20-year-old McCabe fell in love with when he first saw her. She wore her blonde hair a little shorter these days, but there was no gray in it. Her body was almost as lithe and supple as ever. Ronnie inherited her father's darker looks, and darker moods, if the truth be known. At 16, she was turning into a lovely young woman. McCabe already put the fear of God and the special forces into a couple of boys Ronnie dated. They seemed like good kids, so he didn't try to scare them off entirely, but he made sure they knew he was trained to kill with his bare hands, in any number of lethal ways. After Ronnie went off with her dates, McCabe and Terry shared some good laughs at the way the boys' eyes widened while he was talking to them. It was because of the two of them, the two most precious people in the world to him, that he went to work for Megamart. As an independent trucker, he was on the road too much, just to make a living. Terry and Ronnie spent enough time alone while he was in the military. True, as a driver for Megamart, he was still gone quite a bit, but at least his schedule wasn't as erratic. He was usually able to get home several days each week. Sometimes he even managed to be home for 4 or 5 days in a row, like now. He was in the living room of their house in River Oaks, one of Fort Worth's older suburbs, with his feet up, the newspaper in his lap, his eyelids getting heavy. It was Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. Ronnie was out of school today. When McCabe was a kid, they got Thanksgiving Day and the Friday after it off from school, never Wednesday. But she and Terry were busy all day on some sort of project due right after the holiday in Ronnie's biology class. McCabe was willing to help out, but Terry was better at that sort of stuff. She was a teacher herself at one time, although at the elementary level, not high school biology. McCabe gave up on trying to hold his drowsiness at bay and closed his eyes.
Daddy, we're going shopping on Friday. You want to come with?
McCabe tried not to grimace. Since when did kids who lived in Texas talk like streetwise New Yorkers? Of course, Ronnie lived in lots of different places, on lots of different bases. It wasn't like she'd been raised here in Texas. But McCabe, himself a Texan, born and bred, constantly heard Texas-born and raised kids talking the same way. It was because of all the TV and movies they watched, and all the time they spent on the internet, he supposed. American culture was blending together. The distinctive pockets of how people in different parts of the country spoke and acted were slowly fading away. That was good, he supposed, but regrettable, too. Like the seasons, the differences in people made for welcome changes. He opened his eyes.
Shopping? On Friday? Black Friday. The busiest shopping day of the year.
Yeah, we thought we'd go to the grand opening of that new Ultra Mega Mart.
Oh.
McCabe saw enough Mega Marts in his line of work.
Hey, you and your mother can go. Have a great time. All right, I think I'll pass.
You sure? It's supposed to be the biggest Mega Mart in the world. It's as big as a mall all by itself.
If you're trying to convince me, you're going about it the wrong way. Besides, I've seen the place. I know how big it is. I even delivered a truckload of stock there a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. You work for Mega Mart. I forgot.
Yeah, sure you did.
I need some stuff for my project. You think they'll have it?
McCabe didn't bother asking what sort of stuff she needed. If the world's first Ultra Mega Mart lived up to all of its hype, it would have what Ronnie needed, whatever that might be. Parker saw the lights of Islamabad ahead of him as the ancient Volkswagen Bug bounced along the potholed road passing for a highway here in Pakistan. He tried to miss the worst of the craters for fear they'd knock the car suspension out. In America, he would have said a vehicle this old was held together with spit, baling wire, and bubble gum. But he didn't know what the Pakistani equivalent of that phrase was. All he knew was he had to get to the American embassy, get the documents in the hands of people who could do something about it before it was too late. It might be too late already. Here in Pakistan, the hour was just after midnight. That made it Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. Though to the Pakistanis, it was just another day. Pilgrims and parades, turkey and pumpkin pie didn't mean a thing to them. To Parker, it meant he had somewhere between 36 and 48 hours to prevent mass murder. In this age of instant communication, it was an eternity. Plenty of time to do what needed to be done. But if things went wrong, if he failed to deliver the intel, those hours could speed by like minutes. He caught a break when the guy who owned this Volkswagen stopped to ask Parker if he needed a ride. Parker was double-timing it along the road east of the village where the Hizb ut-Tahrir training compound was located. The compound was gone now. The explosions that knocked him out took the compound too. When he awoke, he could see nothing of the compound beyond smoke and fire. He also woke to the pain of shrapnel in his leg. He did his best to patch himself together and headed out. It was several hours later, around midday, when the car came along. The driver saw what appeared to be a fellow Pakistani jogging along the road in the middle of nowhere and generously stopped to offer him a lift. Parker was shocked as hell when he heard the car and turned around to see a Volkswagen Bug approaching. How it wound up here in Pakistan, 30 years or more after its manufacture, he had no idea. But it ran, even though the engine didn't sound too good. Keeping his rifle hidden under his cloak, Parker circled around the front of the car as the driver cranked the window down. The guy opened his mouth to offer a ride. It was a short, sharp punch, knocking the Pakistani senseless without doing any permanent damage. Parker hauled the man out of the car and left him lying on the side of the road. Now, 12 hours later, he fought fatigue, hunger, and wounds to keep the old car on the rutted, potholed road. Every bump threatened to flip the car or knock out Parker with a jolt of pain. Rounding a blind turn, the car sideswiped a man-sized boulder in the middle of the road. The highway was built on a slight embankment with enough of a slope so that the car started to roll as it veered off the shoulder's edge. The bug went up and over, somersaulting, metal denting and crumpling under the impact, sand flying, axles snapping, hubcaps spinning off the tires and sailing through the air. The old German car finally came to a shuddering halt on its top, a good 30 or 40 yards from the road. None of the Volkswagen's windows remained intact. It seemed not a single square inch of metal on the small vehicle was undented. But it wasn't on fire. Parker began struggling to pull himself out through the jagged opening where the windshield had been. He wasn't sure how much worse he was hurt. He toppled all over the inside of the car as it tumbled off the road. Bones had to be broken. He tasted blood in his mouth, along with sand and grit. But he was still alive. As he hauled himself free of the wrecked bug, he told himself he was going to stay alive until he turned over that intel. He felt under his coat and found the documents from the compound. Still there, and they weren't soaked with blood yet. With the lights of Islamabad to guide him, Parker struggled to his feet and stumbled off into the darkness. But he had help. He felt them hurrying him along and giving him strength. All the innocents who would die if he failed. They didn't know it, but they were right there with him in the Pakistani night, urging him on. Hamed didn't try to reach for his weapon. He knew if he did, the woman would kill him. Instead, he stood as still as humanly possible.
What is your name?
Hamed al-Bashar.
He gave his real name instead of the fake one on his false identity papers. He didn't relax until the gun went away from the back of his neck. He wasn't fully at ease even then. He was angry that he had allowed anyone to get the better of him like that, especially a woman.
All right, you can turn around.
Hamed turned toward her. She held the gun down at her side. She wore a sweatshirt with the big letters UTA on it and a pair of blue jeans. The shirt was baggy and at least somewhat decent, but the jeans were immodestly tight. She lifted the hem of the sweatshirt, exposing a few inches of smooth golden brown belly, and tucked the little pistol into the waistband of the jeans.
I'm Shala. Shala Sahi.
Iranian. She was Shiite.
My parents are Iranian. I was born here. My father was a doctor in Tehran until he was forced to flee the Shah. Here, he drove a taxi cab for 20 years, before a crackhead murdered him one night to steal less than $30.
We all have our stories.
Don't take that tone with me, Frenchman.
Children!
This new voice came from a doorway leading into one of the apartment's other rooms.
We are all on the same side here, remember? The infidels are our enemies, not each other.
Hamed turned and saw a familiar face. The last time he saw this man was at the training compound in Pakistan. He was one of Sheikh Abu Ibn Kahir's lieutenants, Mushaf al-Mukhari. Older than Hamed, he had a lean face, balding head, and neat goatee, giving him a look Americans might call satanic. To Hamed, though, the sight of Mukhari was a welcome one indeed. It meant the head of Hizb ut-Tahrir was taking a personal interest in this mission by sending one of his top men to oversee it. Other men emerged from the room where Mukhari had been waiting. They were familiar, too. Hamed greeted his fellow graduates of the training compound with smiles and hugs and backslaps. He counted quickly. 10 men were crowded into the small apartment. That was only half of the force gathering here. The others hadn't arrived yet.
We would have food and drink, Shala.
For a second, Shala looked like she wanted to tell him to get it himself, Hamed thought. Clearly, the evil Western ways embedded themselves in her, causing her to no longer know her proper place. That was apparent from her dress as well as her attitude. But then she shrugged and went into the tiny kitchen to do Mukhari's bidding.
You have come to tell us of our mission, Sheikh?
Mukhari held up a finger and waved it back and forth as he smiled.
Later, my impetuous young friend, when all the others have arrived.
Hamed nodded with downcast eyes. He was impetuous. It was one of his failings. He was so eager to strike a blow against the infidels and die for Allah. He could barely contain himself, especially after living and working among the decadent Americans for months that seemed an eternity. But now he must be patient. He told himself he would be, with the help of the prophet. He waited with the others for the rest of the cell to arrive. He turned to Shala Sahi.
What is your part in this?
I told you my father was murdered by a drug addict. If this country accepted him, as it should have, he would have been working in a hospital somewhere, saving lives with his medical knowledge, instead of driving a cab in the worst parts of Dallas.
I am sorry for your loss. This tragedy led you to become a believer in our cause?
I've always been a follower of Islam. I know I may look like one of them, but I still believe. I still think America is the great Satan.
It figured she would quote the Ayatollah.
You could return to Iran. Such things can be arranged even now.
Why would I want to do that? My family is all dead. I've never set foot in that land. It's not my home. This is. But that doesn't mean I hate the infidels any less.
You just don't want to give up the advantages they give to women. You don't want to don the burqa and live as a proper Muslim female should.
Her face darkened again with anger at the disapproving words. But before she could say anything, Mushaf al-Mukhari lifted a hand and smiled. He didn't have to remind them that they all had a common enemy. Mukhari came to his feet and motioned for all the men to go into the other room, while Shala answered the door and made sure the newcomer was one of their group. If not, she would send whoever it was away. By 8 o'clock that evening, all 20 members of the group were there, packed into Shala's apartment like sardines, as the Americans would say. Like Shala and the Sheikh and Hamed, they all wore American clothes, and although their ancestry was apparent by looking at them, there were millions of fellow Muslims in this country. They would do nothing to stand out, and although some of the infidels would look at them with hatred and suspicion, no one would think they represented a real threat until it was too late, much too late, to stop them. Most Americans would look at them and see convenience store clerks or software engineers and believe these were some of the good Arabs, the ones who adopted Western ways and beliefs, the ones who were glad to be here earning money, buying DVD players and iPods, sending their children to American schools. The only Arabs who really represented a threat were the ones who wore robes and spoke among themselves in foreign tongues and bowed to Mecca 5 times a day. At least, that was what the infidels believed in their arrogance. They thought so highly of themselves and their culture that they assumed just a taste of it would be enough to seduce anyone into accepting their ways. It never occurred to them that someone wearing Levi's and Nikes could be a warrior of the Prophet. But they would find out. To their everlasting regret, they would find out. Private Rigoberto Gomez loved being a Marine. He even loved the physical, mental, and emotional challenges of boot camp at Paris Island, because every day he survived those challenges was one more day he wasn't spending in East LA's barrio, dodging bangers and lowlifes, worrying about drive-bys, and watching his friends die from drugs or violence.
No, don't die, Chewie! Don't die, ma'am!
Private Gomez was doing something with his life, accomplishing something, putting all that gang shit far behind him. Of course, now he was standing guard at the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, where you never knew when one of those crazy suicide bombers might try to crash through the gates with a truck full of explosives, blowing him to hell in the ultimate drive-by, along with as many Americans as he could take along for the ride. Those Al-Qaeda dudes were as mean and nasty as any of the gangs back in East L.A. But Berto Gomez was a Marine now, which meant the whole damn Corps had his back. That didn't keep him from getting sleepy, though, pulling the graveyard watch like this. Nothing was going on. The streets around the embassy were empty at this time of night. Islamabad might be the capital of this country, but it was still a small town in many ways. Well, the streets weren't exactly empty, Private Gomez realized. Somebody was walking toward the main gate in the wall around the embassy compound, where Gomez was posted. Just one guy, but one was enough. He was wearing one of those long cloaks like the Pakistani men wore. With an outfit like that, he could have a lot of explosives strapped to his body. He could be a walking bomb. And he was coming straight toward Gomez. Bartosevich, a private from Cleveland, was on duty at the gate with Gomez. He didn't look like he had noticed the guy yet.
Yo, Barty, one of the locals coming?
Shit, you think he's a suicide bomber?
I don't know.
Gomez thumbed off the safety on his weapon and lifted the rifle.
Halt!
The man kept coming. He was shambling along at an unsteady gait, Gomez could tell now, like he was sick or hurt or something. Or maybe he was just a little scared because he was about to blow himself up. That would be enough to put a hitch in anybody's step.
Halt!
The figure kept moving toward the gate.
Stand down, my man! Right there! Come any closer and we'll shoot!
Bartosevich glanced over nervously at Gomez.
Are we really gonna shoot him?
Damn right we are. Maybe he's just drunk, but I'd rather take a chance on capping him than let him blow us to hell.
Gomez's finger lightly touched the trigger of his rifle. It wasn't easy to shoot a man down in cold blood. He'd never killed anybody in his life. Not back in the streets of East L.A., and not here in Pakistan. But all it would take, he realized as he drew a bead on the cloaked, shambling figure, was just a little more pressure on the trigger.
Semper Fi.
Gomez couldn't understand the words, but he thought the man sure sounded like he was hurt or sick.
Stop right there and get down on the ground. Barty, call the lieutenant.
Already did. He's on his way.
Gomez wished the officer would hurry up and get there, so the decision whether or not to kill this guy would be taken out of his hands. But he would make it if he had to. If the stranger took two more steps...
Semper Fi.
A shock went through Gomez as he understood the words. Bartosevich heard it too.
Shit, Gomez, he's one of us.
Not necessarily. These guys can learn to speak English just like we learn to speak their lingo.
Gomez kept his rifle trained on the figure.
Hey, man, if you understand what I'm saying, stop right where you are. Don't come any closer or I'll shoot you. I swear to God I will.
The man stopped and slowly raised his hands. He was close enough now so Gomez could see his face in the glow from the floodlights illuminating the grounds of the embassy compound. It was the same sort of dark-skinned face Gomez saw hundreds of times a day on the Pakistanis, except this guy didn't have a beard like most of the men around here. The man began fumbling with a turban wrapped around his head. Barty's rifle came up.
He's got a gun in here!
Wait, hold your fire!
Gomez didn't think the guy was going for a weapon. He watched as slowly, unsteadily, the man unwrapped the turban. As the cloth fell away, it revealed hair a dark shade of blonde. A grin creased the guy's gaunt, haggard face.
I'm an American. Got to see the ambassador.
Then his eyes rolled up in his head, and he pitched forward. As Gomez pushed the buttons on the keypad to open the heavily reinforced iron bars of the gate, he hoped the guy had just passed out. Gomez wanted to hear the story of how a blonde American dressed like a Pakistani came wandering up to the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad in the middle of the night. Gomez was willing to bet it was a good one. So, he wasn't dead after all. Consciousness seeped back into Brad Parker's brain. He fully expected to wake up either at the pearly gates or the gates of hell, depending on final judgment. But the first face he saw didn't belong to either St. Peter or Lucifer. It belonged to J. Gordon Keene, United States Ambassador to Pakistan. Keene was a balding, stuffy-looking black man. A former university professor, he still looked it. He glared down at Parker.
Young man, you'd better have a good excuse for showing up unannounced on my doorstep at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Parker recalled that he and the ambassador had never met, though he certainly knew what Keene looked like. Parker's lips and tongue didn't want to work at first because they were so dry, but after a moment he tried to talk.
I need to talk to Ford.
You mean Larry Ford?
Yeah.
The expression of disapproval on Keene's face deepened. Lawrence Ford was a deputy attaché at the embassy, according to the books. He really worked for the company, and Keene knew it. He probably didn't like it much. Diplomats seldom like to acknowledge some problems in the world can't be solved by negotiations. But a CIA presence in American embassies worldwide was a fact of life. Keene looked at somebody Parker couldn't see.
Get Ford in here, now.
Keen turned his attention back to the man in the bed.
How bad am I hurt?
My medical people tell me you have 3 broken ribs, a concussion for sure, and possibly a hairline fracture of the skull. A couple of deep grazes on your right arm and right side, and enough scratches, scrapes, and bruises for a regiment. In other words, son, you're lucky to be alive. And depending on how bad your head injury really is, we're not sure what kind of shape you're in. What's your name? Or are you allowed to tell me that?
Brad Parker, sir.
I suppose it would have been too much to expect for someone in Washington to let me know you were over here in Pakistan?
Things sometimes develop pretty fast, sir.
There was no point telling Keen he had been in Pakistan for months, working to develop intel and do whatever needed to be done. Parker knew, by and large, it was better to keep the paper pushers in the dark. Another man bustled into the room. He was tall, broad-shouldered, starting to develop a little paunch. A pair of glasses perched on his nose.
Brad, old buddy, you look like you just went 6 rounds with a buzzsaw.
Parker grinned, even though it hurt.
At least I didn't start out looking this way, Fargo.
Lawrence Fargo Ford picked up his nickname because of his hometown in North Dakota. He grinned, even though his eyes were deadly serious behind the glasses. When he glanced at Keen, the ambassador gave a frustrated grimace.
I know. I need to leave you two alone.
I'll debrief Mr. Parker and then begin to talk to you, Mr. Ambassador.
Keen nodded and left the room. When Parker and Ford were alone, Ford drew a chair closer to the bed and sat down.
Is this room clean?
Ford reached into the pocket of the robe he wore over his pajamas and brought out a small black box with a tiny lever on it. He pushed the lever.
It is now. We sweep the whole place for bugs pretty regularly. Even if we miss something, this little gizmo will take care of it.
Even the ones that our side planted?
Even them. Now tell me, you ran into trouble in that village? The one where Hizb ut-Tahrir has its training compound?
Had. No more jihad you.
Damn! That's good work, Brad. I heard rumors something big happened over there, but I wasn't able to confirm it.
Parker lifted a hand and reached out toward Ford.
Got to tell you. Documents hidden in my jacket.
I've already got them, but they're, sort of soaked in some of that blood you lost. We haven't been able to translate them yet. Under the best circumstances, it's hard to dig the details out of all...
Parker clutched at the arm of his friend.
I can tell you... They're gonna blow up something in the States on the day after Thanksgiving.
What is it? A political target? Part of the infrastructure?
Worse.
Parker's head pounded fiercely with a sudden pain, sending black flashes across his vision. He was about to say they're going to blow up the biggest damn megamart in the world when something burst inside his skull, flooding it with agony. The whole world was red, then black.
American and Iranian warplanes faced off over the Persian Gulf today. A Pentagon spokesman says the confrontation occurred after the Iranian aircraft threatened to fire on an oil tanker heading into the Strait of Hormuz if it didn't turn back. American fighter jets positioned in the Gulf scrambled to the scene, and according to the Defense Department, the Iranian jets retreated. However, Tehran charges its planes came under fire without warning or provocation. The Pentagon denies any shots were fired and has released a recording of the Iranian pilots threatening the tanker. Meanwhile, the president issued a statement reiterating U.S. commitment to finding peaceful solutions to the problems in the Middle East, but warned Washington will not permit any disruption of shipping in the Persian Gulf. Tehran decried the statement, charging the administration with meddling in the affairs of sovereign nations. Iran has long claimed the Strait of Hormuz as a territorial possession that it can shut down at any time. Heightened Middle East tensions appear to be having little effect on the American consumer. With the Christmas shopping season poised to officially begin tomorrow, the day after Thanksgiving, retailers are looking forward to booming sales. All indicators point to a retail bonanza, as people will be shopping more and spending more this year.
The president's chief of staff carefully strode into the Oval Office.
Madam President, you'll be leaving shortly to go to the soup kitchen.
The president stood at the window behind the desk in the Oval Office. The glass was bulletproof, of course. In fact, it was so heavily reinforced it might as well have been a sheet of armor. But it couldn't keep out the bad news. Nothing could.
Oh, I don't suppose I could beg off this year, given the circumstances in the Middle East.
Well, you could, I guess. But you made it a tradition to help feed the homeless on Thanksgiving. It would look bad to the press if you skipped it, unless we were actually at war or something.
Or something.
The leader of the free world rose from sleep before dawn with the news Navy fighter jets and Iranian planes almost started shooting at each other before the Iranians decided to turn tail and run. Would they do the same thing next time? Who knew? That was the problem with fanatics. You never could predict with any reasonable sort of accuracy what they might do. Washington was gray and overcast on this Thanksgiving morning, matching the president's mood. The leaden sky looked like it might produce some snow later in the day. By then, she would be back from the homeless shelter, where she would dish up turkey and stuffing, cranberry sauce and giblet gravy, to the unfortunates with nowhere else to go this holiday or any other day. Nothing said compassion like a photo op of the president helping out the homeless. And right now, returning to her roots as a champion of the unfortunate and disenfranchised wasn't a bad idea, because fresh polling data showed the electorate held little faith in her ability to handle the crisis in the Middle East. No surprise, considering her anti-war, anti-military background. People expected her to roll over and give the country's enemies whatever they wanted because, well, because that was exactly what she did in Iraq, wasn't it? But she did it because the polls said the country wanted her to do it. It wasn't fair for people to turn on her just because things turned out so badly there. It wasn't her fault. Nothing was her fault. It was all because of the vast web of conspiracy crafted by her enemies. The same web of conspiracy, no doubt, behind JFK's assassination. Of course, JFK became a beloved martyr. She forced those thoughts out of her head. She didn't have time to get bogged down in them now. She had homeless people to feed. All the evening newscasts, broadcast and cable, would lead with the footage of her standing in the homeless shelter in an apron, dishing out Thanksgiving dinner. People would see and know how good, how moral she was. They wouldn't be thinking she was liable to let things in the Persian Gulf spiral out of control. At least the election was almost a year away. By then, people would forget all about this little glitch in the Middle East. They would return her to office for a second term, as long as nothing else bad happened before then. Allison Sawyer was up early on Thanksgiving Day. Even though it was just her and Nate, she wanted to fix a traditional Thanksgiving dinner with turkey and all the trimmings. Her parents lived in Waco. She and Nate could spend the day with them, but Allison knew too well how spending time with her parents led to arguments. Her folks never approved of her marriage, and never shied away from letting her know their feelings. Of course, as it turned out, they were right about her choice of a husband being a bad one, but that didn't mean she wanted to hear about it over and over. So she got everything cooking, then woke Nate so they could watch the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade together. He always got a kick out of the giant balloons, and to tell the truth, so did Allison. At the end of the parade, there was Santa. His appearance always made Allison think of the old movie Miracle on 34th Street. It was a pleasant way to spend the morning. After dinner, she could read or nap while Nate watched the Cowboys play on TV. Allison was a Cowboys fan when she was a teenager, but she sort of lost interest in the sport after Troy Aikman retired. She supposed she never was all that interested in the games themselves, just a certain number 8. Nate surprised her as they relaxed after dinner.
Hey, Mom, can I go to Megamart tomorrow?
Well, I don't know. I planned to get Mrs. Sanchez to watch you while I was gone.
Their neighbor in the apartment house babysat for Nate pretty often. They got along well.
Yeah, but I want to go. It's the grand opening.
Allison hesitated, The real reason she couldn't take Nate with her was because she intended to do all his Christmas shopping at the new Ultra Mega Mart. There was a huge ad for the place in this morning's paper, and in the few looks she sneaked at it, she already saw several things she thought he might like from Santa. She couldn't very well get them if he was there at her side. That would spoil everything.
No, it'll just be a big mob of people. You wouldn't enjoy it. I'll take you there later on a day when it won't be quite so busy.
But, Mom!
I've already asked Mrs. Sanchez to have you come over, and she said she'd be glad to. You wouldn't want to disappoint her, would you?
What about me being disappointed?
She reached out to tousle his hair.
Don't be like that. You've got your whole life to go to Megamart. I promise you, they're not going away. Now, is it still halftime of the game?
Yeah.
What's the score?
The Cowboys are ahead 14-3.
Good. Maybe they'll win.
People told Ellis Burke he was lucky to get the house in the divorce. Burke didn't see it that way. He knew he got it, only because Rebecca didn't want to put up a fight for it. She wanted to move out and get a fresh start, she said. Sure, it meant taking Vicky out of the only home she ever knew, but Rebecca didn't care about that. As usual, Burke thought bitterly at the time, his wife wanted what was best for her, and if anybody else didn't like it, too bad. So he was left to live in the 10-year-old brick house that looked like all the other 10-year-old brick houses in the vast subdivision, with all its memories of good times and bad. The housing market was in a slump, even with all the fantastic growth in the area. No way could he get what the house was actually worth. So he couldn't afford to move, not with the child support he was paying. He woke up on Thanksgiving morning in the bed he once shared with his wife. He walked down a hallway once littered with toys and ate breakfast at an island countertop in the kitchen where his daughter used to eat cereal every morning. Then, faced with a long day of nothing to do except go over paperwork from various cases he was working on, he went into the den and made himself a drink. If he were home in New York, he could get together with friends, watch the parade from somebody's penthouse, go out on the town, take in a show. But in this cultural wasteland, there was nothing to hold his interest. He flipped through the ads in the local newspaper, the only reason he subscribed to it in the first place. He certainly didn't rely on it for news. The thick ad for the new Ultra Mega Mart caught his attention. He went through it carefully, and sure enough, there on page 5 was the puppet thingy Vicky wanted. For a really good price, too. Burke suppressed a groan as he saw the small print reading, "Limited to quantities on hand, no rain checks." He turned back to the first page of the section. Doors open at 6 a.m.
Shit.
Anybody who got up at a reasonable hour and arrived at the store at, say, 10 o'clock in the morning would be out of luck. All the good stuff would be gone by then. He would be faced with forcing his way through a mob of sweaty rednecks looking for something, anything, confident only in the fact whatever he got, his daughter wouldn't like it nearly as well as the freaky-looking puppet. Burke tossed back the rest of his drink and thought he would just forget the whole thing. He made a good living. He could afford to go out somewhere and pay more for the thing later without ever venturing into Redneck Central.
Ah, damn. If I wait, I probably won't be able to find it anywhere else. Shit.
He recalled stories on the news in past Christmas seasons about near riots at toy stores when people tried to get their hands on that year's hot toys in short supply. Like it or not, and he sure didn't, he decided his best course of action would be to drag himself out of bed early and head up the interstate a few miles to that blasted grand opening. It would be an ordeal, but he told himself he could stand it, for Vicky's sake. With that decision reached, he made up his mind about something else. He got up and went to pour another drink. There was nothing special about this Thanksgiving, and that's what made it seem so nice, McCabe thought, as he, Terry, and Ronnie sat on the sofa watching to see if the Cowboys' place kicker would make the field goal to win the game. It was just Thanksgiving dinner with his family, followed by a nice nap, then a football game that turned out to be close and exciting. He wasn't on the road somewhere hauling a truckload of goods along the interstate. nor was he freezing his ass off in some mountains or sweltering in a jungle or scorching in a desert while people who hated the United States and everything it stood for did their damnedest to kill him. He spent more than one Thanksgiving like that. It was no fun.
He's gotta make this kick.
The opposing team called a timeout to let the Dallas kicker stew some more.
He's just gotta.
McCabe's daughter was a diehard Cowboys fan. As for himself, he liked to see them win, but he wasn't going to lose any sleep either way over something like a football game. The teams lined up. 3 seconds remained on the clock. The ball was on the 30-yard line. That would make this a 47-yard field goal. Difficult, but possible. The Cowboys were 2 points behind. The new stadium, opened just a year earlier, was packed with screaming fans. They were all on their feet as the ball was snapped. McCabe felt some of their urgency and leaned forward on his sofa as the kicker stepped into the ball and swung his kicking leg. The camera followed the ball up and up.
It looks like it's long enough. It's straight enough. It's good! It's good! No time left on the clock! No penalty flags out! Cowboys win! Cowboys win!
Woo! Yeah! Woohoo!
Ronnie jumped up and did a little dance, pumping her fists in the air. Her parents grinned at her, but she was too excited to notice.
Well, that was certainly a thrilling finish. I think I'll make myself a turkey sandwich. Anyone else want one?
McCabe rubbed his stomach.
Oh, God. I'm still too stuffed from dinner to even think about eating again. How can you be hungry already?
I have a healthy appetite.
Yeah, I'll say.
She punched him on the elbow, then stood up and headed for the kitchen.
Hello?
She detoured a few steps to answer the phone. McCabe wondered who would be calling on Thanksgiving Day. Probably one of Terry's relatives. He didn't have any close relatives left. That was one reason he made the military his career for a long time. It took him by surprise when she held the phone out toward him.
Jack, it's Keith Gossage.
McCabe frowned. Gossage was one of his supervisors. As he stood up and went to take the phone from his wife, he wanted to ask what the hell they wanted with him on Thanksgiving. But she hadn't covered the receiver with her hand, so he didn't.
Hey, Keith, what's up?
I'm sorry to bother you on Thanksgiving, Jack, but at least I waited until the Cowboys game was over.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
I know you thought you were off until Monday.
Oh, no. Don't tell me.
I'm sorry, buddy. Hiram Stackhouse needs you.
Stackhouse was the founder of Megamart, a multi-billionaire, an elderly man who was either a colorful eccentric or a crazy old coot, depending on who you asked about him.
Uncle Sam needed me, too. That like to got my head shot off.
Well, at least you won't have to worry about that tomorrow. And you won't have very far to go, either. You just have to pick up a load of freight at the Alliance Distribution Center and peg it to the new Ultra Mega Mart that's opening tomorrow. Won't take you more than an hour or so, I'd guess.
That store's not even open yet. It should be fully stocked. They can't be running short of anything yet.
That's where you're wrong. The guys in marketing have been running the numbers. They've decided that the turnout for the grand opening is going to be bigger than they first thought. So they ordered up extra stock in certain areas.
McCabe didn't care what the stock was. It could be anything from diapers to automatic transmission fluid to hairspray. It didn't make any difference to him. All that mattered was he had to get it from point A, the distribution center at Alliance Airport, to point B, the brand spanking new Ultra Mega Mart. And on a day that was supposed to have been time off for him.
I don't suppose it's too much to ask if you've got anybody else who could handle this job.
Now, you're the best, Jack. You know that.
His superiors in Spec Op said that very thing to him on more than one occasion, especially when they were sending him into some dangerous third-world shithole from which they didn't expect him to come back. But he fooled them. He came back every time, and for the most part intact, though not always. He had the scars to prove it. Gossage made the job of driving a truck some 5 miles sound just as vital. And McCabe supposed it was, to Gossage and his bosses, all the way up to Hiram Stackhouse. McCabe heard rumors the old man himself was going to be on hand tomorrow for the grand opening, although not officially announced yet. Stackhouse liked to just show up with little or no warning. That was part of his eccentric charm.
All right, Keith. Okay. I'll take care of this for you, but you are going to owe me.
Extra time off later? You got it, buddy.
I was thinking more along the lines of a bonus.
Well, I'll see what I can do.
Gossage didn't sound too hopeful. Like George Halas, the old-time NFL big shot who once owned and coached the Chicago Bears, Stackhouse carried a reputation for throwing nickels around like manhole covers.
What time do I need to go pick up the load?
8 o'clock. It'll be loaded and ready to roll. See, I told you this won't take very long and you'll have the rest of the day off, just like you planned.
Okay, I'll be there.
I knew I could count on you, Jack. Thanks.
Yeah, take it easy, Keith.
Don't tell me. You have to work tomorrow.
Yeah.
I was counting on you going with us to the grand opening.
Well, that's where I'm going. I have to pick up a truckload of extra stock at Alliance and drive it over to the store.
That means you can meet us there and go shopping with us after all.
McCabe was starting to feel trapped in more ways than one.
You know, I already told Ronnie that I thought I would pass.
But now you have to be there anyway, so you don't have any excuse for disappointing your loving wife and daughter, now do you?
You're right. Things really are working out for the best, aren't they?